This episode is for my mother-in-law, Mary Meesom. Daughter, sister, mother, aunt, and grandmother, who loved her heritage and her family and her stories. She is remembered, missed, and loved in return.
Tá an episode seo do mhaithe chéile, Mary Meesom. Inín, trifuair, mhaithe, antín, agus seanmhaithe, ar a gráthaí dá éireacht, dá chlán, agus dá scéalta. Chuimhnítear uirthi, mhaithe an siúin, agus dá grá ghuin dí mar chúte.
In 1806, a merchant cargo ship set sail from the port of Cork in Ireland, bound to New York, a normal enough event for the times. Cork's location gave it access to the most profitable routes between Britain and North America, especially with provisions exports. The warmth of summer meant sailing conditions would be at their best. But of all the fortunate circumstances that favored the crew on that voyage, none was greater than that of the ship itself. For there was nothing normal about that ship. By all accounts, it was a magnificent vessel, larger than any other sailing from Cork, or Ireland, or the whole of the known world for that matter. This beloved ship, that was like none other, was a sure bet to deliver the cargo and crew to the port of New York. But like so many Irish stories, this one ends in tragedy. The great ship sunk, its crew lost. Even the captain's dog met with a watery grave. That is, for all but one. There is one survivor who lives to tell this story, or to sing it, as the case may be. This tragic Irish story is one of the most famous folk songs, well, pretty much ever. It has been covered dozens of times, sung in endless pubs, and is still a favorite today in Ireland. In fact, I bet you a pint that you sang it recently on St. Patrick's Day. It's one of the most popular Irish folk songs around, but why is it still treasured and sung to this day? Is this song evidence of a real historic event? If it's not, then what's so memorable about one song, about one ship, its cargo and crew, and its complete destruction? Ah, but for one, there's one very special lucky person that survives that destruction. They're the ones that are telling us what happened on that journey into that magnificent ship. But how much of this story is just a folktale versus actual events? Is there any truth to what this single surviving crew member is trying to tell us? Welcome to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. On this standalone episode, let's hear the story of the Irish Rover. The exact date the Irish Rover was written is vague, and its authorship is largely attributed to the traditional folk song composer Joseph Mary Crofts. Joseph Mary Crofts, or J.M., as he was referred to, is a bit of a mysterious figure himself. Found in the 1911 census working as a delf and hardware merchant, living in Dublin, there's not a lot of information easily accessible about his life. Besides being a merchant, Crofts was a prolific composer and arranger, often collaborating with his brother Gerald. He is credited with penning a number of Irish songs and was relatively well known in 1920s Dublin. One of the first mentions that I could find attributing the Irish Rover to J.M. Crofts is in the 1951 catalog of copyrighted music in the Library of Congress. But even stranger than not knowing when the song was written or knowing more about its supposed composer, there's really very little known about the song itself. Was the Irish Rover a real ship or based on a real ship? What about its crew and cargo? If it's not historically based, is it an allegory or just a tall tale to be sung for fun in pubs? I'm all for singing songs in pubs and having that be the end of a good story, but there's something very different and intriguing about the Irish Rover beyond just its exaggerated storyline. Its meaning continues to be a puzzle. In researching the Irish Rover, I reached out to a number of academics, music historians, Irish punk rockers, and they all said the same thing. There is something very specific and different about the song, but nobody can really pinpoint what or where it came from or really what it means. But they can't just dismiss it either. So while better minds than mine have tried, grab yourself a pint and let's listen to the story of the Irish Rover. A folktale is a story passed down from one generation to the next, an oral tradition of a group of people. They're told instead of read in a book, and often the tale makes it into song, because why just tell a story when you could sing it? But told or sung, one of the big parts of a folktale's purpose is to impart some lesson on the listener, or to remind them of a code of ethics or values that's important to the culture telling the story. Like with many traditional folk songs, there are different versions of the Irish Rover, with varying lyrics and lengths. And like traditional Irish folk songs, each verse carries a very simple rhyming form. Called an AABA form, or a chain rhyme, it's the linking together of stanzas, or a grouped set of lines within a poem. The rhyming words carry from one stanza to the next, making the song flow. But even here, the Irish Rover doesn't quite fit. Chain rhymes rely on constantly following the same repetitive patterns and putting the stress on the same rhyming words. The Irish Rover starts each stanza with this form, but soon breaks it with inserting rhymes every line instead of every other. Beyond this odd rhyming form for the Irish Rover, they're the lyrics themselves. Our song starts.
On the 4th of July, 1806, we set sail from the sweet cove of Cork. We were sailing away with a cargo of bricks for the Grand City Hall in New York. 'Twas a wonderful craft. She was rigged fore and aft. And oh, how the wild wind drove her. She stood several blasts. She had 27 masts, and they called her the Irish Rover.
A simple enough start. The purpose of the Rover's trip this time was exporting bricks to New York City for their new city hall. In 1802, a competition was held for the design of the new city hall, and 26 proposals were submitted. First prize was $350 and was awarded to John Macomb Jr. and Joseph Francois Magin. Construction was delayed until 1803 due to objections by the Common Council that the design was too expensive. The size of the building was reduced to keep costs down. Construction moved slowly due to labor disputes and a yellow fever outbreak. Workmen earned $1 to $1.50 a day. The building was dedicated in 1811, but did not open until 1812. So the Irish Rover's 1806 voyage was potentially a fit for their timeline. In the 1800s, Ireland's quarries did produce cement and building materials. Companies that sold these goods were located close to ports that could do a good trade with towns on the seaboard. In the 1890s, there was also a number of brickworks in Ireland, but the demand for cement and bricks greatly depended on the state of the building industry. For many of these, opened only when demand was very high, and the industry suffered from competition with British exports. Brick-making operations were also local craft-based practices, without the financial means to develop into a more highly industrialized process like their British counterparts. The ship itself is detailed, "'Twas a wonderful craft, she was rigged fore and aft." Fore and aft is one of two basic types of sailing rigs. A fore and aft sail is set parallel to the ship's body, with the sails capturing the wind on either side of its masts. Historically, this represented an important advance over the ancient type of sails because of its ready maneuverability and its facility in tacking into the wind. From the description of a fore and aft sail, the Irish Rover sounds like it would have been a schooner. The defining thing for a schooner is that the aft mast, or the mast towards the back of the ship, must be the same height or greater than the foremast, the mast in the front of the ship. Schooners were initially defined as having two masts. Three-mast schooners were first introduced in around 1800. The most mast recorded for a schooner is the Thomas W. Lawson, 475 feet overall length, and supported seven masts of equal height, which carried 25 sails. While seven masts is impressive, that's 20 short of the number on the Irish Rover. To accommodate 27 masts, the ship would end up being roughly over 2.5 miles long and about 125 feet in width, much larger than any seafaring vessel today. But even at this enormous size, the wild wind drove her on transatlantic routes, and the ship withstood many blasts, which in nautical terms could refer to either a sudden and violent gust of wind in short durations, or to blow up with gunpowder.
We had 1 million bags of the best Sligo rags. We had 2 million barrels of stone. We had 3 million sides of old blind horses' hides. We had 4 million barrels of bones. We had 5 million hogs and 6 million dogs and 7 million barrels of porter. We had 8 million bales of old nanny goat's tails in the hold of the Irish Rover.
So there, docked at the port of Cork, the Irish Rover is an unparalleled vessel. Any real mercantile ship represented a costly investment that had to keep hauling to make a profit, and so would be the case for the Rover. She would have been expensive to build, maintain, and staff with a crew, about ready to embark on a prestigious job exporting Irish bricks to America. But the rest of her cargo, what is filling the hull of this massive ship, is junk. Things that have no apparent value. How does this make sense? If the purpose of the song is to be exaggerated, then wouldn't the hull be more rare and precious objects? How are the owners of the Irish Rover not bankrupted if this is their choice of exports? Some of my favorite research done for this topic comes from Professor Josephine Maltby, Management School, University of Sheffield, from her article, Financial Reporting and Cultural History, A Contribution. She writes, "The Irish Rover has enjoyed a long popularity as a piece of traditional music, covered by numerous musicians, more than 20 recordings since 1960. There have been, despite this high profile, little exploration of the song's significance in Irish history. In particular, its unique status as a piece of financial reporting has attracted no attention. This paper intends to open up an understanding of the song's contribution and stimulate a wider exploration of the links between culture and financial reporting. The Irish Rover is, I will argue, a very early financial report. The term report is chosen advisedly. The song is not a financial statement. There is no monetary value invoked, but it is the account of an economic project." Using accounting principles, Professor Maltby opens an interesting line of inquiry and logic. What does the nonsensical cargo of the Irish Rover tell us about the song and about the culture it came from? Professor Maltby continues, "Verses 3 and 4 are a very detailed statement of the inventory. The text may be corrupted here. The quantities of cargo given generally seem very high, and there may be some confusion between million and the Gaelic word mile, which is equal to thousand in English. But the disclosure of the use of recycled materials, old nanny goats' tails, and blind horses' hides is striking for the period." While the Irish Rover may greatly be exaggerating their cargo, exporting from the 1700s to 1775 in Ireland increased in value almost 5 times, with cattle and their products among these tripling in worth. Hemp, flax, and linen multiplied almost 30 times in value until they accounted for 52% of the earnings of all Irish exports. Then, in 1798, inspired by the American and French revolutions, Ireland's resentment erupted into a major rebellion against British rule. The insurrection was launched by a group whose goal was aimed at nothing less than overthrowing Ireland's servitude to England for home rule. The British soldiers vastly outnumbered the United Irishmen. They also fought with guns, while the main weapon of the Irish was a long stick with a metal top called the pike. While the pike was useful against cavalry attacks on horseback, it was not against armed British soldiers. The 1798 Irish Rebellion was quickly suppressed. While Cork was relatively untouched by the rebellion itself, the United Irishmen had been active in the city for some time prior to the outbreak. The military authorities took severe action against those found guilty of being members of the United Irishmen. Many were transported and shot by firing squads in a field on the western edges of Cork City. As a result of this rebellion, England enacted the British Act of Union 2 years later. This act made Ireland a part of the United Kingdom and abolished the 500-year-old independent Irish Parliament in Dublin. Ireland was completely under the jurisdiction of Britain's Imperial Parliament at Westminster, England. From this point on, Ireland's economic development and stability was tied to Britain. Proximity to the most advanced industrial country in the world compelled Ireland to concentrate in industries where it had some competitive advantage, processing raw materials produced in the agricultural sector. One advantage Ireland industrials had over their British rivals was the lower cost of unskilled labor. Agricultural labor in Britain was cheap relative to the rest of the British Isles, and they could provide raw materials derived from agriculture at a lower cost, namely linen and brewing. At this time, the Port of Cork was the leading commercial port of all of Ireland and possessed the largest slaughtering houses. The slaughtering season started in September and continued to the end of January. It's recorded that over 100,000 black cattle were killed and cured each year in Cork, largely for British export. Pig production had always been important in Ireland as well. For many small farmers, the income they derived from pigs was almost as great as that is from cattle. The export of salted pork was a large industry, as well as Ireland shipping over 20,000 live pigs a week to England. Britain also imported munitions from Ireland. In 1805, the Ballincog Royal Gunpowder Mill, 8 kilometers east of Cork, was the most important military-industrial complex in Ireland and Britain, employing several hundred people as well as providing gunpowder for all major British offenses across Europe. Cork also had large tanneries, salt, lime, and chemical works. The cargo of the Irish Rover reflects the export from Cork during the early 1800s, right after the Act of Union. The best Sligo rags was perhaps linen. The stones, gunpowder paste rolled into balls before drying for better storage during travel. Bones, the calcium bases for chemical work. The raw goods of agricultural work or the sides of old blind horses' hides, nanny goat tails, and hogs and dogs are close to hides for tanning and pork for salted pork. The porter or alcohol is another popular export. But even with this sizable economic trade, by the mid-1800s, many English politicians and social reformers believed that Ireland needed modernization. In a period of history when poverty was thought to be caused by bad moral character, the Irish working class were perceived as backwards, drunkards, and equal turn violent and slothful.
There was Barney McGee from the banks of the Lee. There was Hogan from County Tyrone. There was Johnny McGurk, who was scared stiff of work, and a man from Westmeath called Malone. There was Slugger O'Toole, who was drunk as a rule, and fighting Bill Tracy from Dover. And your man Mick McCann, from the banks of the Bann, was the skipper of the Irish Rover.
This perception again plays out in the crew of the Irish Rover. All but one crewman is from Ireland. All are identified by their counties. These stereotypes helped to enforce Britain's control over the Irish economy. Needless to say, the Act of Union and its colonial assumptions were not well received or endured by the Irish people. In a quote from The History of the Irish Rebellion from January 1, 1809, John Harsop says, "Our lawmakers contrive to make spirituous liquors more general to us than our bread. They are constantly canting the drunkenness of the people, and take no pains to discourage distillation, as it raises the value of their lands. They accuse us of drunkenness. They export our raw materials. They say we are idiots and mock our poverty. Thus the necessities of our lives are put out of our reach." In the early 1800s, there was a strong sentiment against Britain being voiced in Ireland, and the next 100 years would not ease this discord. Tension between the two coexisting countries only became worse. Between 1845 and 1855, Ireland lost a third of its population. 1 million people died from starvation and disease, and 2 million immigrated in the Great Famine. The blight and failure of Ireland's potato crops in the early 1940s brought on the danger of mass starvation, but it was arguably the response of the British government that brought forth the true crisis. Concerned with modernizing Ireland's economy and reforming its people, Britain made the decision to introduce radical free market reform to Ireland and not to intervene. This laissez-faire approach was also still coupled with the notion that poverty was a moral failing and the famine was God's divine intervention. Author John Kelly writes that the British government at the time viewed the crop failure as a visitation of providence, an expression of divine displeasure with Ireland, and mostly aimed at its Catholic peasant population. At the time of the famine, the population of Britain still depended heavily on Ireland for a wide range of goods. In the 12-month period following the failure of the potato crop, exports from Ireland included horses, ponies, bones, lard, animal skins, honey, tongues, rags, shoes, soap, glue, and seed. Ports situated in some of the most famine-stricken parts of Ireland were sending cargoes of foodstuffs to Britain weekly. So even though the potato crops were destroyed, other crops and livestock continued to be exported from the country in 1845 to 1846. Although the poor were facing starvation, prohibiting food exports would have gone against the popular laissez-faire economic philosophy of Britain. But beyond starvation, what decimated the Irish population during the famine was disease, and most of these diseases that killed people were infectious. These diseases took advantage of the fallen nutritional status and the general environmental deterioration. As the families worsened, so did the community resistance. Family structures, medical services, sanitation, all support structures weakened under disease and famine. Most of the deaths from disease during the famine were attributed to fever, dysentery, and smallpox. These three highly contagious diseases had already reached epidemic levels in Ireland. Their destructiveness was intensified by the presence of other epidemic infections, especially tuberculosis, bronchitis, influenza, pneumonia, diarrhea, and especially measles.
We had sailed 7 years when the measles broke out and the ship lost its way in a fog. And that whale of a crew was reduced down to two, just myself and the captain's old dog. Then the ship struck a rock. Oh, Lord, what a shock. The bulkhead was turned right over. Turned nine times around and the poor old dog was drowned. I'm the last of the Irish Rover.
The undoing for the Irish Rover was initially disease that eliminated all but two of the crew, the narrator and the captain's old dog. Unable to navigate in the weather, especially with the loss of the crew, this last verse tells us the final dark fate of the Irish Rover. The great ship hits a rock and sinks, leaving only one survivor. About 50 years after the horror of the Irish famine, on Easter Sunday, 1916, several hundred armed citizens rioted across Dublin, stormed a British government building, and proclaimed independence for Ireland. The leader was named Patrick Pearse, and for a short time, he and his followers were in control of much of the city in what is now called the Easter Rebellion. The 1916 uprising was another boiling point of long simmering tensions in Ireland over the roughly 700 years of British colonial rule. Like other rebellions against the British rule before it, the Dublin uprising was ill-fated from the start. British authorities launched a counteroffensive, and the uprising was crushed. Pearse and 14 other nationalist leaders were executed. The conspirators would all face tragic ends for their acts, which would irreconcilably alter the course of Irish history. There's a famous song about this revolt, written in 1916, the year it occurred. One of the most popular songs in Ireland even today, it's called Easter Week. The words are by Francis Gernad. The music is by Joseph Mary Crofts. The Act of Union, the Potato Famine, and the Easter Rebellion. These events tell a 100-year-long story of Ireland's struggle through oppression and famine. Did Joseph Mary Crofts tell the very same tale in The Irish Rover? The ship leaves the port of Cork on July 4th, the same day as the American colonies declare its independence from Britain. She's going to give bricks to fortify the city hall at the capital of American commerce, New York City, where thousands of Irish immigrants fled during the famine. 1806 also marks a historic bloody attack on Irish immigrants in New York when a mob attacked worshippers gathered for midnight mass at St. Peter's on Christmas morning. The ship itself is unparalleled and is built to withstand anything, and it's as big as an island. And while she is powerful, her job is to give everything she can away to others. The Rover is exporting massive goods from Ireland, millions of barrels, bales, pounds, all of it going somewhere else. Nothing is staying in Ireland. Not even the refuse or scraps of nanny goat's tails are being left behind to help sustain the Irish people. When the famine hits Ireland, the British government makes the decision not to intervene and continues exporting Irish goods under the delusion that this famine and the disease it brings in its wake is divinely ordained as God's will wrought on an ignorant nation. A million people die. Like the Irish people, the Irish Rover loses its way in the fog, unable to navigate a clear horizon of its own independence. Its crew, decimated by disease, cannot right the ship. A passage in the book The History of Commercial and Financial Relations Between England and Ireland by Alice Murphy says, "There is no country in the civilized world with such a melancholy history as Ireland. From the time when she first entered as a tangible factor into the English history until the closing years of the 18th century, the prevailing note is one of gloom." And then finally, the 1916 Easter Rebellion uprising is crushed by British forces. Dashed on the rocks, its Irish revolutionary leaders executed, there is little hope to be had. The massive ship turns 9 times around and sinks. Even the last loyal true symbol is lost as the poor old dog drowns. All of his melancholy and gloom, but for that one last line. Because who is telling the story but the Irish man or woman who survived all of this? After all of these events, historic and embellished, the Irish people survive to sing about it. And while the story itself a tragedy, the song is raucous, joyous even. If he was the author, J.M. Croth has written a song about rebellion that's happy. You remember it, and that makes you want to sing it. And that's lasted all the way to this day. Maybe the song is an embellished folktale played at pubs for St. Patrick's Day, or when you're listening to the Pogues. But every time it's sung, not only do we hear the story of the Irish crew and their fantastic ship, but we are reminded that after everything, they survived, and you are singing their story, even today. So dear listeners, hoist a pint. Here's to the last of the Irish Rover. Listening to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. Next episode, we'll finish up with Denver International Airport and then start sharpening our pencils to send you all love letters from Circleville, Ohio. It's the story of one private detective search for an anonymous author whose dark letters wrecked families, tore apart a community, and even may have led to a murder. So until then, remember, keep listening. Want to know what Whatever Remains is getting up to next? Follow us on Twitter at Whatever Remains or online at whateverremainspodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to the show and give us 5-star review on iTunes, unless you are my mom who is still holding at 3. Seriously, your reviews help others find the show, and we love to hear from our listeners, so please reach out. Our music is by Group Rona. The Irish shanty you've heard is by The Mermaids. Our logo is by the super talented Desdemona. Voice talents for this episode was from Jim D. Johnson and my most lovely niece, Alana Nolan. Copyright 5 Orange Pips Productions, all rights reserved.